This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. More than 90 million Americans are seeing temperatures above 90 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona was the hottest metro area in the U.S. today at 111 degrees. CBS's Chris Van Cleve says there have been some heat-related deaths.
In Death Valley, California, a 65-year-old man was found dead in his car the morning after the temperature hit 126. And tragedy in Lakeland, Florida. An 18-month-old baby died after being left in a hot car overnight. Her parents, Joel and Jasmine Rondon, were arrested. This is the 10th child to die in a hot car so far this year.
President Biden has decided to give cluster munitions to Ukraine for the war against Russia.
It took me a while to be convinced to do it. But the main thing is they either have the weapon to stop the Russians now from their keeping them from stopping the Ukrainian offensive through these areas, or they don't. And I think they needed them.
That's Mr. Biden on CNN. The United Nations has recommended that cluster bombs not be used. The self-proclaimed white supremacist who killed 23 people at an El Paso, Texas Walmart store is sentenced to 90 consecutive life sentences. CBS News legal contributor Jessica Levinson.
The prosecutors laid out these hate crime charges, also charges dealing with firearm offenses, and the defendant in this case agreed, I will plead guilty, and in exchange, the federal death penalty is not on the table. And that is a common negotiation technique.
Mosquito abatement is at the top of the to-do list in Sarasota, Florida, after confirmed cases of malaria in some parts of the county. Wade Brennan with the Sarasota County Mosquito Management Services says teams are trying to trap the mosquitoes before cases rise.
If we do find the vector, then we're going to take immediate action with some truck treatments or aerial treatments, or also doing backpack treatments, and we're going through yards.
Health officials are already thinking about fall and winter, and they're working on preventing a repeat of last winter's tripledemic of respiratory illnesses. Details from CBS's Christopher Cruz.
The plan involves multiple vaccines. The CDC is recommending that we get one for COVID and another for the flu this year, and for those over 60, one for RSV. But, says Dr. William Schaffner, professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, not all three at one time.
Flu and COVID are well studied. They work well together. RSV and flu, it resulted in a somewhat diminished response on the flu side. So I think RSV probably ought to be taken alone, separate from the other two.
This is CBS News.
Find great hires fast with Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring solution makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Here's what you need to know in northwestern Wisconsin. Good afternoon, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers visited Boys and Girls Clubs across Wisconsin on Thursday to promote his budget signing. Among other things, Evers used his veto pen to increase public school funding for the next 402 years, and Evers said it was important to invest in education for the future.
There's lots of changes that have happened along the way that they need to adapt to, but at the end of the day, they're our future. And having some guarantee that there's going to be some increase 400 years from now, I think that's important.
Republicans are considering a lawsuit over the 402-year budget measure for schools. Howard Markline, the co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee in the state legislature, called Evers' tax priorities misguided and said that the annual increased spending on schools would lead to larger property tax increases. And it should be comfortable weather this weekend if you're heading out on the lake or into the woods. Temperatures will be in the mid-70s to mid-80s with some scattered rain chances throughout the weekend. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
What is the grand prize? Is it a fabulous cash prize?
You definitely get to take home the cheese. I know that.
I hope so. Humans aren't necessarily logical creatures. Maybe it is.
Thrill seeking.
It's the thrill of the cheese and the bragging rights.
The first person across the line wins and gets to keep the cheese.
And that's it.
And I think that's it.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Tired of hearing only one side of the story? Do you want news and information from people who, like you, know what it's like to work hard every day and still struggle to make ends meet? Then tune in to the Rick Smith Show every weeknight from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Be part of the conversation. Tune in, turn on, and take back the American dream. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Albaugh Show, weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Albaugh Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. It's what's on tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5 The Tap.
Deciding whether a species deserves protections.
Good. We will take what we can get. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Fastest growing economy of the G7 countries. Fastest recovery of all of the G7 countries. Lowest inflation rate of the G7 countries. Unemployment rate 3.6%, nearly a five-decade low. Wages are now growing faster than inflation. Things are going right. Things are going in the right direction. We're rebuilding manufacturing. We're doing a bunch of infrastructure. We're doing stuff, getting stuff done, getting good stuff done. Stuff we should have done, years ago. Things that another guy, you may remember his name, weird-haired guy, always tweeted a lot. Tweeted a lot about how we were going to do infrastructure, how we were going to make the country great again. We were going to bring back jobs. We were said a lot of words. There were a lot of words. There were words. Now, the words were empty, hollow, and worthless, but there were words. There were lots of them. In fact, we had lots of photos. There were lots of photo opportunities. There were lots of PR stunts, lots of gimmicks, lots of, hey, look at me, not got anything done. Didn't do anything. In fact, during the 4 years of the weird-haired guy and the tweets, nothing. Nothing got built. Nothing got done. Jobs didn't come back. We were promised we were going to reshore manufacturing. Promised we were going to save that plant in that GM plant in Lordstown, Ohio. Lots of promises. Didn't do it. Didn't do it. But there is a guy. there's a guy who I affectionately call Jelly Bucket Joe. Jelly Bucket Joe shows up. Biden the Builder doing the work. And I spent a little time over at invest.gov today. And it was one of those things you go, wow, I didn't realize all of the things that we were doing. Spending about $503 billion committed so far. Private investment, about $503 billion to bring semiconductors. Now, we're paying a little bit. I think a small percentage of this is coming from the taxpayer. But look, we need to reshore and fast. But $231 billion in semiconductors and electronics. This is the frontier of the new world. This is what you have to build this stuff. You have to have the capacity. And, you know, thanks to corporate America, thanks to our well-heeled, well-funded, well-paid CEO class, we've lost this. And again, you know, I hate to say that we lost it. We know where it went. They took it over to China. They took it over to Southeast Asia. Because, hey, we can get cheap labor. We can exploit cheap labor, put that exploitation in our pockets. That's what corporate America decided. And they funded a bunch of politicians to help them do it. Now you got Jelly Bucket Joe going, hey, we're going to resource some of that stuff. We're going to bring those jobs back. And they better be union jobs. We're building EVs and batteries, $134 billion in private investment going into that. Clean energy, $104 billion in clean energy going there. $19 billion in biochemicals and $14 billion in heavy industry stuff. We're building stuff. Building stuff. And look, at the end of the day, the virus, you know, kind of, I think, I hope, if there was a positive to come out of this, we realized how dependent we are on parts of the world that don't like us very much. We find out that, you know, we should probably be building stuff, lots of stuff. And I look at the fact that Biden has done an incredible job, in my view. He really has, just hasn't done the kind of, hey, look at me. He's Jelly Bucket Joe. He just shows up. He just does his job. The fact that they've added during his term, in the 29 months that he's been president, they've added 13.2 million jobs. Let me say that again, 13.2. I know, but Rick, those were all the jobs that were, you know, that were lost during the Trump years because of the virus. They just all came back. No, they didn't all just come back. You don't just flip on a switch and go, everybody come back now. There's actually a process that goes through this. Now, that's more than any president during a four-year term ever. Good on him. And it's because of the legislation that they moved. And in some cases, got, you know, a minute amount of bipartisan support. So we're calling that infrastructure bipartisan. Not so much. A lot of people on a bipartisan basis just want to take credit for it. Think the dumbest guy in the Senate, Tommy Tuberville. But we've got a strong foundation to build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out. We have an opportunity. And again, you know, his words, bottom up, middle out. Instead of the other way, there was a guy with slicked hair, a movie actor, you said a lot of lines, memorized the whole term. Oh, yeah, Ronald Reagan. The trickle-down stuff, trickle-down doesn't work. We figured that out. I think we figured that out. I think finally we have figured being trickled on, not good. I'm sure there's some people out there who prefer that, and that's their thing. And whatever you do within the confines of your four walls, that is your business. But in economic terms, it doesn't happen. Sorry, doesn't happen. I'm sure there's somebody out there who, like I said, enjoys being trickled on. Economically, it's not happening. There were no rivers of gold and honey. There was no manna from heaven. The only trickle is, well, you figure it out. But here's the thing, and this is where I keep coming back to. The jobs are roaring. You know, hundreds of thousands of new jobs. A couple hundred thousand jobs this month. More people right now. I just saw this weird statistic. The highest level since 2001. I'll get it right. More people 25 to 54 are working since 2021. More women 25 to 54 are working. The highest participation level in decades. Now the right's going to go, well, you know, there are all those jobs, but, you know, participation, people are too lazy to work. Nobody wants to work anymore. People are lazy. Well, these numbers are kind of showing, no, not so much. If wages are going up, people are going to want the jobs. And we're seeing that. And it is a good thing. I think it is a good thing. It's something we need. Now, the problem that we have is, and this is the weird part, you look at Biden's approval ratings, and they aren't great. Let's go with that. Not great. The fact that, you know, we had the fastest growth rate of any of the G7 countries. We've recovered faster than all of them. The inflation rate's much lower than all of them. You know, we've done so much better than everybody else. And yet, Biden's economic approval ratings are are actually 7 points worse than his overall number, which is not great either. And to me, this should show us that the right-wing media sphere, this is what they're capable of. They flood the zone with horrible. They flood the zone with fear. They flood the zone with total BS. There's a recession coming. Didn't you know there's a recession right around the corner? Every day. When's the recession coming? You know, Biden economics is going to cause a recession. Biden economics is bad. And the reality is as they're still doing this, as it's still coming out of their mouth, as they're still wishing and hoping and, you know, in hands, the economy's still steaming along. Now, you go, but, you know, that's not all Joe Biden. No, it's not all Joe Biden. It's his policies. We're investing in stuff. The people who invest in buildings and you know, new startups, they see opportunity because you've got a government that says we're going to help. You know, as I said, I spent some time over at invest.gov, and I highly suggest that you do, because you can go through, and they've broken it down into private investment and public investment. You can see where the private investment is going. You can see, you know, places where, you know, chip manufacturing is happening. You can go to places where, you know, clean energy is being done. You can go to places where, you know, they're building factories. They're bringing jobs back. Or you can go and say, hey, look, you know, I want to see what public infrastructure is being done. How many projects are being done in my neighborhood? And I did. There's several in my neighborhood right now being done to help improve our lives. And I did this thing of, you know, just kind of scaling back to the whole country. And literally there isn't a place. I couldn't find a place where there wasn't really a public sector project happening. Every state, almost every piece of real estate, there's something going on. There's something happening in every state, and especially in the states that voted against Biden, which is weird. Again, the people who voted against him are reaping the benefits. And there's part of me that goes, you know, that jaded part of me, that part of me who could never be president, because, you know, I probably would be like Donald Trump and say, if you didn't vote for me, well, you're against me, you get nothing. Because I've always said, if you voted against the infrastructure bill, you don't get anything in your district, because you're not representing your people. And maybe the people there will go, hey, you know, we want roads and bridges. Hey, you know, we need infrastructure. We need an airport. We need the work done. We need new sewer lines. We need new power lines. We need broadband access. And yet your representative and my representative, Scott, pardon me, Perry, voted against all of this stuff. And yet in my district, there are things going on where he's going to take credit for. Look how wonderful. Look what I fought for. You voted against it, Scott, pardon me, Perry. And this is the weird, weird moment. And I think this is why Democrats are doing more, I think a little bit better. And I give them credit. They're trying. This Investing in America website, invest.gov, has some cool stuff on there. I still wish it was a little flashier. Still wish it was a little more interactive, where you could, you know, maybe like Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, did, put that live stream on that project that's being built, so you can go, hey, let's see what's going on over there. And you could actually see your tax dollars at work and know that. And of course, I would want a giant Joe Biden pointing at it going, I did that, you know, image in the corner. But there's a lot going on. And it's weird to me, because I had this conversation where someone was, you know, telling me how bad things are, you know, how horrible the economy is, how inflation's killing everything, and how, you know, we're heading to this doomsday. And I finally said to him, I go, you know, where are you getting your information on this? Where's this all coming from? Yeah, inflation is not great. But understand, you know, if wages keep up, inflation isn't bad for the working class, especially if you're a debtor. Especially if you have a mortgage like virtually everyone in the working class. Not a bad thing. Again, as long as wages keep up. And this is where, you know, I look at what's going on, and we're going to talk about a little bit later about UPS. This is why workers organizing so very important. And why I love Jelly Bucket Joe. I got to tell you, I love the guy. The fact that he's saying, yeah, we're going to bring those jobs back and they're going to be union jobs. They're going to have good wages and benefits and security and the things that families desperately need. Because ultimately, when you look at what's going on, this is about families. This is about communities. This is about restoring dignity to those places that for too long, the largest employer in town is the hospital and the drug treatment center. It's time to get back to, you know, what people my age and older remember as the American dream. And you got a guy in the White House, and look, he remembers, you know, 80 years old? And I don't care. All the people who sent me emails saying, oh, he's 80 years old, don't care. Love the policies. If you can look at Donald Trump and say he's crazy, he's a criminal, he's doing all this insane stuff, he's dangerous to national security, mishandling classified stuff. If you can get away with saying, but I like his policies, I can do the same thing. I'm still trying to figure out what policies Trump championed other than, hey, look at me, how wonderful I am. But, you know, it is what it is. I like Biden's policies moving us in a positive direction. Now, I look at Kevin McCarthy every day putting out a tweet saying how bad things are. Still have no idea where Kevin McCarthy, where his eyes are and what he's seeing. I'm seeing a future. Not sure what Kevin sees. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I come back to the policy stuff. I come back to the fact that Jelly Bucket Joe gets it. My boy Builder Biden on the right course came out and talked about these. And I remember this during the Trump years. Was dead set against these scam insurance, these short-term insurance things. You know, and Biden came out and said, look, you know, we got to crack down on these things, on these short-term plans. He called them a scam, said you can't leave Americans being played for suckers. This is good. He said, you know, in America, it sounds corny, but is fairness something we kind of expect? And I don't know anybody who likes being used, having been played for a sucker, taken advantage of. People are ready to meet their responsibilities. But I think this is a big deal. And I think it's time to start getting away from some of this stuff. These short-term plans during the Trump years were left unchecked. You know how they go. You know, we're going to get you the minimum coverage you need. We're going to get you the health care you need. We're going to give you a wonderful card, and it'll look shiny in your wallet. And you'll feel all secure knowing that, hey, I got health care. And it's like, you know, it's like eight bucks a month. And you go, wait, what kind of health care do you get like that? You know, it reminds me of, you know, my son and I had a conversation just the other day. Well, we're both learning to ride motorcycles. And we had to go get insurance because my son bought a motorcycle. So in order to get the motorcycle, got to have insurance. So he's like, you know, my friend says insurance is like $100 a year. And I'm going, no. So we went through my insurance company. It turns out it's $800 a year for him. And what it is it covers him against real loss. So I showed him, I sat him down and we went through, this is what you get for $100 a year. This is the $100 a year plan. It is like $5,000 in damage and it's $15,000 in medical. That's it. It is the bare state minimum. Doesn't cover anything on the bike. Doesn't cover anything. Covers virtually nothing. Now here's what we got. You know, $100,000 and $300,000 in damage and all in the health care that if you get injured, there's all that. If your bike gets totaled, you'll get, you know, comprehensive collision. There's all this stuff. And this is the difference between what the Affordable Care Act was trying to do, saying, hey, we're going to make sure that there's bare minimum coverage here, that you're going to get checkups, that you're going to get, you know, you're going to get care when you need it, and it's not going to make you go broke. And then these scam plans that go, I've got health care. It doesn't cover anything, but I've got it. So good on Joe. Good on Joe for speaking out. Let's quick go to the phones. We've got Kurt in Tucson, Arizona on line one. Kurt, how we doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I am doing great. What's on your mind?
So I want to just add to the, I'm so optimistic right now about the future and bringing people together. On Monday, my wife and I were going to Ukraine. We've been taking classes for like a year with, do you know who Timothy Snyder is?
I'm afraid I don't.
He's a professor at Yale on the history of Eastern Europe and Ukraine.
Okay.
And he's created a program called Making a Modern Ukraine. And what we're going to be doing, what we're starting off with, is we're going to be documenting the war in Ukraine. And then in the whole program of the Making the Modern Ukraine, there's a lot of global initiatives that's going to start coming out of working together on a global level. And not only will it help Ukrainians, but it'll help us and all the countries that are participating in it. I'm so optimistic about this, Rick, and I think just for the countries as a whole, it just the idea of us working together and at the same time working for a better, like, economies for, you know, not only for Ukraine, but it will help the United States as well. There's a whole lot of initiatives.
Yeah, I mean, all of Europe. I mean,
this whole program.
Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe. I mean, there's a lot there that needs to be done. So good on you. So you're going to Ukraine, not worried about safety, not worried about what, as an American going somewhere, like, not worried about, you know, something going on.
You know what, Rick? I feel very secure, and the reason why I say that, I know my wife would not, if she wasn't secure, we wouldn't be doing this.
I was going to say, I thought she was going to take care of you. You know, anybody bothers you, she's going to knock them out. I thought that's where you're going.
Right. But the people we're working with, I feel very secure with, and they are not going to lead us into harm's way. And we're not necessarily going to the we're not going to the front line,
right,
per se.
Of course not.
There's places where, I mean, you can look at a map and know that, hey, this is not the place to go. And not that the country is not, you know, things can happen, but I feel secure. And
good.
And I don't think the Ukrainian people we're working with would lead us into harm's way.
Well, it's great to hear from you again. I wish you the best. Stay safe, and when you get back, I'd love to hear about your trip.
Yeah, I'll have some good things to share with you.
I hope so. Thanks, Kurt. Appreciate it.
All right, bye bye.
Wow, good on him, man. This is one of those things where, you know, when you look at me, I scream American. You go, hey, there he is. There's the American. Go get him. So, you know, I give credit to people who put themselves in that kind of peril and are willing to do that. I know in that situation, no matter where it is, they're going to go, there's the American, get him. And that's going to be one of those things that I end up getting got. But good on him. I mean, the reality is we need, the globe needs a democratic Ukraine. And not, you know, with our thumb on the scale or anyone else's thumb on the scale. But, you know, the fact that Russia was moving in that direction, it's not good for the globe for Russia to start wanting to get the old gang back together. And the fact that Biden, again, I give him credit for doing the right thing. We did not put boots on the ground, which I was against from the beginning. We did not get it. We did not go in and take over, which I say was the right thing. But we did make sure that the people had what they needed. And we're still doing that. Now I come back to manufacturing. Had we all those manufacturing plants that we allowed to go under, this would have been a lot easier. Something we got to talk about. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day thousands of Pullman strikers confronted state militia forces at the Grand Trunk Railroad crossing in Chicago. The strike began on May 11th after George Pullman slashed wages but refused to lower rents in his company town. In late June, Eugene V. Debs and the American Railway Union called for a national boycott of all Pullman cars. The boycott spread to 27 states, involving more than 150,000 workers. Attorney General Richard Olney issued an injunction declaring the strike illegal on July 2nd. The injunction failed to break the strike, but it did prevent union leaders from communicating with strikers. The next day, President Cleveland ordered troops into Chicago rail yards to crush the strike. Workers were furious. They flooded the yards, stopping trains, smashing switches, and barricading themselves with baggage cars. Fighting continued for several days as angry strikers stormed rail yards and overturned empty freight cars. Thousands of workers impacted by the Depression joined in, including those stranded in the city after the Columbian Exposition. Two strikers were shot dead on the Illinois Central Railroad on July 6th. Workers responded by setting fire to hundreds of rail cars. Now, on this day, the militia attempted to run a work train to clear the rail yard at 49th and Loomis. Thousands followed the train, showering it with bricks and stones. The troops returned gunfire, killing at least four and injuring dozens. Chicago unions soon voted in favor of a citywide sympathy strike, but the railroads quickly hired replacement labor. Federal troops and state militia cleared the railway for business. Maine strike leaders were arrested. By the beginning of August, Pullman rehired only those strikers who agreed to never join a union.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The political extremists demanding that government control every woman's personal reproductive decisions claim that they are pro-life, but that's a rhetorical fraud. Look at their overall policy agenda, and you will see that they are merely pro-birth. After that, adios, baby, good luck. They consistently join Republican lawmakers to kill public programs that deliver essential real-life needs to babies after they're born. Consider child care, a fundamental need in any society, yet the leaders of our rich, sophisticated nation that supposedly treasures family, work, and children have created a Mengi system that literally is a crying shame, revealing that our society deliberately does not care for children. Here's reality for you. 98% of American workers are better paid than those we entrust to care for our children. Working at a nail salon, loading boxes at an Amazon warehouse, flipping burgers at McDonald's are jobs given more pay and respect than most child care jobs. This is not just a poor people's problem. For the lack of child care availability, affordability, and quality is a looming crisis for a majority of American families. Nonetheless, Republicans, enabled by corporate Democrat Joe Manchin, recently killed funding for a program to both raise worker pay and lower the prices families are charged. Such care is too expensive, squawked the same lawmakers who routinely dole out billions in welfare to corporate profiteers. But wait, the GOP has come up with a genius, low-cost solution. Relax safety and educational requirements for child care centers, as Iowa and Montana have already done, allowing 16-year-olds to provide care for up to 15 children each. This is Jim Hightower saying, to support life, not just birth, join up with the First 5 Years Fund, FFYF.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for our, especially for our folks in Minneapolis listening on KTNF AM 950, tomorrow, big day of, it's Solidarity Saturday. I want folks to find their local UPS store, their local UPS hub, and maybe adopt a informational picketer right now. Could be a striker very soon, but get to know where they are. As I say all the time, every person during strike time, you should be adopting a striker and help spread the word, help give support, and, well, help your community. And that's why I have asked Scott Wilkie to come talk with us. Scott Wilkie is the communications director for Teamsters Local 638. There in Minnesota. They cover Minnesota and North Dakota. Their website, teamsters638.com. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for reaching out. I really appreciate it.
So tell me what's going on tomorrow, Saturday. What's going on in your neck of the woods out there in Minnesota?
Right. So if you've seen on social media, we've began across the country for UPS Teamsters. We're doing informational practice pickets to raise awareness on a potential strike here in a few weeks. And we're going to hold hopefully one of the biggest ones in the country tomorrow morning, Saturday, 8 a.m. Central Time to about 11 a.m. At the UPS Minneapolis Broadway Hub, which is sort of the heart of our local. And we've got a lot of people coming out. We've got local media coming out. We've got Teamsters Local 120, which represents UPS in South Dakota, coming down. We've got MNA, which has about 15,000 members, they're going to show up. Education Minnesota, Minneapolis Federation of Teachers 59, AFL, the list goes on and on. SEIU supporting it, and some politicians that are very pro-labor as well plan to show up. So it's going to be a big event. If you are in the Twin Cities, we ask that you just come and walk the line with us. We'll have some music, we'll have food, and a lot of solidarity.
You know, I've been saying that this could be one of those moments, Scott, you know, like your neck of the woods back in 1934 helped move the freight industry in the right direction. This could be one of those moments that helps an industry, helps the logistics industry, the package delivery industry to rise all boats, to make living conditions better, to make wages better and working conditions better. Because you guys, I got to tell you guys work in some pretty desperate conditions. The heat in the summer, the cold in the winter. I don't think most people understand that.
No, and especially up here in the Midwest, you know, we get it all up here. We'll get, you know, sub 30 degrees in the winter, and we'll get 110 degrees in the summer. Before coming on to the local in this role, I was a UPS driver for 13 years and a steward. So I've done the job. I did it through the pandemic. This contract for us is about a lot of things. You know, right now we're hung up at the end on part-time pay. We can talk about that, but you know, for our drivers, it's really the working conditions and quality of life. The back of the package cars, they have clear roofs. It'll, you know, the temperatures up there are so hot, you feel like you're literally cooking. We have people that get sent to the hospital every single year. We've had people that have died on the job from the heat. In the winter, you know, we've had people that get frostbite. It's, you're out in the elements, you know, a lot. There's not a lot we can do to control it, but, you know, getting air conditioning in the package cars is a huge step in the right direction. Getting adequate heat for the winter is a step in the right direction, but also controlling the amount of hours that the drivers work in a week. You know, right now UPS has come out and said, well, you know, these drivers that, you know, they make X amount of dollars, you know, a full scale package car driver makes $93,000 a year. Well, that statistic is true. You know, I did make that through the pandemic, but you're working 6 days a week, forced overtime. If you don't work those hours, then you face discipline from the company for not working those hours. And you're watching your kids grow up through Facebook posts and putting them to bed through FaceTime. And that's not what anybody wants, right? People need to be able to get home and see their families. And so we're getting quality of life language, but also language that provides us just a safe working environment. And really that, again, to your point, sets the standards in labor. That's what the Teamsters have always done. We're proud of our history in Minneapolis for, like you said, setting those standards. And we have to continue to do that because then everybody in the logistics industry benefits, right? Yeah. And that's the big picture perspective.
Now, you mentioned the pandemic, and one of the signs I have here in the studio says essential work should pay off. It's one of the UPS signs that we got when we were on our Working Class Heroes radio tour. And that should be the minimum here. I mean, this is a wildly profitable company. Last I saw, and maybe you have bet different numbers, but $13.9 billion in profit last year. I don't know how much of that is minus all of the stock buybacks and all of the stuff, the sweeteners that they put out for their for the shareholders and their CEOs. But $13.9 billion, that's not shabby.
No, and, you know, for us, we look at that like those are profit margins that are reflected by paying your people substandard wages, right? The sacrifices, again, that the workers have made personally and professionally and working, you know, working through the pandemic. We didn't have, you know, vaccines, of course, but we didn't have masks. We didn't have hand sanitizer. We didn't have anything. And people were out with COVID and we didn't have any therapeutics. We didn't know what was going on. We had people die. Right. And then what happens on the back end is the company says, oh, we don't have enough, you know, money to give you guys. Sorry. But we know they're a publicly traded company. Out of one side of their mouth, they'll say that we made record profits. And then all the other side of their mouth to us, they'll say we don't have enough money. But, you know, a number like that, I mean, even on a bad year, quote unquote bad year that they're on right now, where they're still making billions of dollars a month, they can afford to raise part time pay to a respectable level to where, you know, people aren't on assistance, aren't on, you know, food stamp programs, aren't on subsidized housing and those things where they can afford to have a respectable life outside of work for the work that they do to this company and what they've built it to be.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. There are 340,000 part-time, full-time UPS workers, members of the Teamsters Union. A large percentage of that are part-timers who during the pandemic were, you know, heaped with praise. These are folks who, you know, they were the heroes. They were essential. I'm sure you've heard all of that. Locally, where I'm at in central Pennsylvania, the hub here was paying their part-timers $24 an hour to get them in the door. And then, you know, recently, you know, a couple months ago, I guess, arbitrarily, they just decided, you know what? We've decided we're going back to the $14 an hour and just arbitrarily took that money back that these folks, you know, were earning. This, to me, large slap in the face, especially when you're making $13.9 billion in pure profit. I got a problem with that.
Yeah, we've had the same issue. I mean, it's been a national issue with the MRA abuse, really. You know, you lure people in, they leave other jobs because they see this, you know, shiny new job over here that might pay $4 or $5 an hour more. And then they pull the rug out from underneath them after a few months. And, you know, UPS management, if you ask them, will tell you that the best production and workforce they had was when they did raise the wages, because now, you know, these folks can't walk down the street and find a job with similar pay, and the job matters more to them. And you create, again, a better quality of life for folks. And that's what we want to get back to. But we need a contract with language that doesn't allow for that anymore. If you pay somebody a wage and you hire somebody at a certain wage, you can't pull it up from underneath them later. It's completely unfair. And it's caused people to lose money, not only because now they're getting paid less, but also they may have left a job where they would have made more had they stayed. And that's completely disrespectful. And you can't have that anymore.
I know people who, you know, they took the job, hey, I'm going to make $24 an hour. And then they're like, what? They can do this. Yeah. And the shock was that legally they can get away with it because the contractual language puts it at a certain rate. So I remember during the thing saying, hey, you probably should be negotiating at least the people who got hired this to keep at that level. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Scott Wilkie. Scott's the communication director for Teamsters Local 638. Out in Minnesota. They cover Minnesota and North Dakota. Check out their website, teamsters638.com. We'll get links out on social media. Now, I'm sure you've seen the news like I have. Nobody knows what's going on behind closed doors at the bargaining table. But, you know, the news media is kind of throwing this out as, you know, well, both sides walked away from the table. You know, both sides pushed away. And, you know, and UPS is, you know, saying, no, we still want to negotiate with the cost neutral language that we threw out. Are you getting any sense of any thoughts on on? What's going on? Are your members, feeling a little anxious? What are you seeing?
Well, from our perspective, and everybody I've spoken with, and if you watch any of the interviews that our General President Sean O'Brien has done, that's not what happened, right? I wasn't in those rooms, and even if I was, I couldn't talk about what happened, right? But everything that we've heard is that at 4:15 in the morning, UPS said, well, this is the best we can do, and we know it's not the best they can do. The offer that they gave for our part-timers' wages was completely disrespectful. And frankly, we know what the part-timers are worth, and they know what they're worth. So even if hypothetically the Teamsters had agreed to whatever that low proposal for wages was, the majority of the Teamsters at UPS are part-time. And so that contract wouldn't have been ratified anyway. So it's really a waste of time to slap part-timers in the face with low wages. You have to pay part-timers what they're worth.
That is an excellent, excellent point, Scott, because, talking with some of the part-timers, they're like, look, they hired us in here at $24 an hour. That's what we're worth. That's what we're getting. And I haven't even heard them anywhere close to that. So it seems like, it doesn't matter what O'Brien does, the membership, they've got it in their head. They want much better.
Right. And so kind of to your point there is it is about the membership. That's what they've hired, us to do, is to represent them in their needs. We've got thousands and thousands of proposals for the 22.5 language, which is language that covers those part-time wages. And they all need increases. And all of those increase in those proposal numbers were all relatively similar. They know what they're worth. And it's our job to work with UPS to get them what they're worth. Otherwise, we can't get a contract.
Yeah,
right?
What they earn. I mean, people say what they deserve. No, it's what they earn. They should get what they earn. Now, what do you say, Scott, to the people who go, well, they already make too much. They make more than FedEx. They make more than Amazon. UPS just can't sustain that. What's the argument against that?
Well, I would say that I'd say a couple of things. Personally, I'd say
keep
well,
it clean. No profanity, please.
I think you guys should organize, right? Because I think you're worth more. And, so for me, my wife's a union nurse, right? And here in Minnesota, there's a huge strike with MNA. And here's what happens. The MNA goes on strike. They get what they're worth in their contract. Out in New York, a few weeks later, New York nurses go on strike and they piggyback off. So we know what we're worth because they know what they're worth out there. They get better wages and benefits. Even if you're not directly affected, if you're in the industry, you are positively affected, because for one of our UPS hubs, for example, up in Maple Grove, Minnesota, literally on the other side of the street is an Amazon hub. To the south of it, on the other side of that street, is a FedEx facility. So if those folks know that the grass is greener on the other side, they're just going to go across the street and apply, right? And so it forces other people in the industry to raise standards of their work environment, of their wages and benefits, to get the people what they're worth. If you're working as a nurse up here in the north where we are, where we're all union nurses and they get paid they should get paid more, but they get paid pretty well. If you're in the south, those hospitals know that if they don't take care of their people, they'll just move north where wages are better. So it raises the bar for everybody. And that's the strength of a union, right? Is raising the bar and raising the standards for labor so that people don't get exploited.
Yeah. It's all about wages, hours, conditions. So let's go back to Saturday, all across the country, Solidarity Saturday, informational pickets. I'm sure it's going to be fun. There's going to be a lot of party atmosphere, all of that stuff. And I hope folks will find their local UPS hub. And as I've said, on every strike, go adopt a picketer. But here's the thing. The very real reality is the days are ticking away to where this could be real. Any thoughts on the possibility of this happening?
Well, I think everybody's, hopeful that UPS will, do the right thing and not strike themselves. I mean, it's basically one issue right now. And again, I don't know all the details, right? There's a non-disclosure. I'm not at the table.
Sure.
But everything that we've been told from our leadership says that we're hung up on part-time wages right now. And UPS has the money to do it. They need to give our leadership a call and let them know, hey, we've got a respectable offer here for you. And then it's over with. It's really that simple, but nobody wants to see a strike. It's the last resort for everybody. But the bottom line is that we can't continue on this path. I worked as a UPS driver throughout the pandemic, and I could go on and on and on about how hard it was, but we can't continue on this path because it's just not sustainable for their workforce. Yeah. So we need positive change, and UPS needs to do the right thing and set the example of what a company should do for its people and reward them. And then we all move on and keep the supply chain moving.
There you go. Scott, I wish you guys the best. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this continues down the road. But for all across the country, find your local hub in Minnesota. Our friends listening on KTNF AM 950, 8 a.m., I guess, in the Minneapolis. What's the address there again?
We're located in Minneapolis here. Teamsters Local 638 office is located in Minneapolis. We also cover North Dakota, but we're in the central time zone.
There you go. Scott, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Thanks so much. Look forward to talking to you again.
I appreciate it, Rick. Have a good night.
As I've said, find yourself a spot tomorrow. Go and adopt a striker. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1998. That was the first day of a 48-hour general strike in Puerto Rico. The strike was called in support of telephone workers who had walked off the job 3 weeks earlier. The workers were protesting government plans to sell off the publicly owned telephone service to GTE, a private company based out of Connecticut. As the strike of the telephone workers continued, more and more Puerto Ricans rallied to their cause. A general strike was endorsed by more than 50 unions, along with other civic, political, and religious groups. The group of organizations leading the strike went by the acronym CHAOS. For 2 days, the general strike shut down almost all activity in the nation. Work at stores, banks, and the halls of government ground to a halt. Transportation ground to a halt as bus drivers and taxicab drivers took to the picket line. Many in the crowd waved Puerto Rican flags. In the streets, the chant could be heard, Hilga, Hilga, or Strike, Strike. Many also chanted, Never surrender. The telephone company belongs to the people. The strike won support outside of Puerto Rico as well. The Health and Hospital Workers Union 1199 in New York issued a statement of solidarity and a $100,000 donation to help support the cause. After the success and support of the general strike, the telephone workers remained on the picket line. The strike wore on for 41 days. In the end, GTE won the day. The company promised not to retaliate against any striking workers. But when they took over, the company reduced staffing through so-called voluntary layoffs and early retirements. This is yet another chapter in the fight against privatization.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So it's just like high school, evidently, in Congress. You know, how bad is it when the House of Representatives is this screwed up? But evidently, the Freedom Caucus, otherwise known as the Crazy Caucus, the Crazy Conservative Caucus, the House Freedom Caucus, they ousted Marjorie Trainwreck Greene. They threw her to the curb because evidently, and I don't even actually know why, she's crazy like they are, but just not the same kind of crazy, I guess. She's kind of teamed up with McCarthy because she's smart enough to know, you know, to go towards a path of power, try and grab the gavel. Because I can see at some point Republicans losing their minds even more and making that one the speaker. That would be hysterical. That would be well worth the price of, you know, losing the country, I guess. But the House Freedom Caucus is trying to notify her that she's been ousted and she won't return their call. And I'm going, you know, it's just like high school. And now they're going back and forth over. Very, very funny. You remember me talking about the Moms for Misery, the Maniac Moms for Misery conference that happened in Philadelphia? Moms for Liberty, funded by right-wing billionaires and, with an agenda to destroy public education. You remember them? They had a guy who came and spoke. His name was Ryan Walters. We've talked about Ryan in the past. He is the Oklahoma State Superintendent. He's the top education guy there. He was doing a little radio gig, I guess. And he's arguing that teachers, shouldn't talk about race, shouldn't mention race when they talk about the Tulsa race massacre. The 1921, you may have heard this story. In fact, we do a labor history in two on this, that on a day in May, I think it was May 31st into June 1st, you had, what was known as Black Wall Street in Tulsa, where you had, thousands of, black families who owned homes and businesses, and it was a thriving community, a thriving black community that a bunch of white people got angry at and burnt it all down. And they're saying, according to the Oklahoma Historical Society, what they have written is, quote, believed to be the single worst incident of racial violence in American history. The bloody 1921 outbreak in Tulsa has continued to haunt Oklahomans. During the course of 18 terrible hours on May 31st and June 1st, 1921, more than 1,000 homes and businesses were destroyed, while credible estimates of deaths range from 50 to 300. By the time that the violence ended, the city had been placed under martial law, thousands of Tulsans were being held under armed guard, and the state's second largest African-American community had been burned to the ground. Now, Mr. Walter, the state superintendent, the guy who's the head of the school there, he says, quote, to say it was inherent that because of their skin is where I say that is critical race theory. Let's not tie it to the skin color and say that the skin color determined that. We're whitewashing Black Wall Street burning? And the answer is, yeah, we shouldn't talk about who it was. Yeah, there's some homes that were built. They were burned down. People lost their life savings. People lost their lives. But nobody knows why. There's no reason. Who knows? Who knows? And this is the weird thing. This is what the Moms for Liberty group, is talking about. We can't talk about what was racial. Now, understand, when we did our civil rights tour back in 2015, we went to a lot of places where black people were treated really badly. And now you have, these museums and these institutes and all of these things that have popped up going, hey, tourists, come see how bad we were to black people. And look, there were some really, really great places that we went to where the history is there, because I wanted my kids to actually learn history, not this whitewashed version of, there was a fire. There were some buildings that were burned. Still not sure why this area of Wall Street-ish kind of place was attacked. Nobody knows why. It's a mystery. It's completely a mystery. Maybe it was spontaneous. The gods were angry. This is the kind of history they want taught, which is dangerous. Now, as I said, we took our kids around and we went to places where really bad, where they were hanging people and burning people, and our history, not good at all. But here's as I'm looking at this stuff, and there was some pretty, really bad stuff. In fact, a couple of them, because we had small kids, the curators would go, hey, for this section, can we bypass this with the kids? And I'm like, oh, absolutely. If we're going to see burning bodies and in all kinds of, they don't need to see that at 5 and 6 years old. They just need to know bad things happen. They got the point. At no point did I feel responsible. Now, I'm a white guy. I'm told I should feel guilty. I don't. I didn't do it. But what I can say is, my ancestors did, people of the past did, and they're responsible. And how about we not do it again? See, here's the part where I look at someone like Walters, I look at these maniac Moms for Liberty, I fear these are the people who go, we should do that again. worked out really well the first time. That's the fear. So you learn history so that you don't make the same mistakes. And you don't just take quotes from history, like North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson says. We need to learn the quotes of Hitler and Pol Pot and those such. Because there are some folks who think, you know, Hitler got railroaded, RFK Jr. This is why education is so important. And this is why the right wants to destroy public education. They want to privatize.